It's time for some collective wisdom, a podcast advancing the cannabis revolution one conversation at a time. We all benefit from sharing knowledge and experiences. So if you want to learn about the business of cannabis from those in the trenches, you've come to the right place. Here's your host, Lisa Tolner, co-founder of SensiChew.
So welcome everybody to the first episode of Collective Wisdom, a podcast about the business of cannabis with our host, Lisa Tolner. Hey, Lisa, how are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Well, I'm excited at the prospect of talking about this emerging industry. Here's an industry being born before our very eyes. Everything from the how it operates to how it distributes to how it packages to how it sells this new product is being imagined as we speak. How did you get into this business? Let's give us a little background on Lisa. Who are you and why are you doing this show?
Well, I got into this business really quite by accident. It was not intentional. And in fact, when my husband came home one day and said he wanted to get into the cannabis industry, I said, are you nuts? Why on earth would you want to do that? We still had teenagers at home in those days. And I was really, the more I could tell he was really serious about it, the more worried I became. Because in those days, the stigma was pretty powerful, you know, for kids in school, no zero drug policy. If you got caught with anything, you were expelled. And
Right. And
I was really worried about my family and my children.
It wasn't an acceptable business for some credible business person to be in.
Absolutely true. And I was just really concerned that this was not the direction I wanted to go in. And so, right. But my husband had other ideas and I said, okay, well, you go ahead and try it, but keep it away from me and the kids. And that was kind of how we started. But the more he was into it and the more I was watching him and learning from him and watching the people, and he had a small dispensary and people were coming in and out of the dispensary that were clearly not well. You could tell people had just undergone chemotherapy. You could see some were war veterans. People were clearly not feeling good and they were going to get their medicine. And that really made an impression on me. And the more I thought about it, you know, what am I being so scared about? So in the evenings when the dispensary was closed and it was quiet, I would go check it all out. And back in those days, there wasn't much in the way of edibles. You had your flower, you had your pre-rolls, and you had brownies and cookies, and that was the extent of it.
Brownies and cookies, yes. Back to the earliest days of cannabis consumption here.
Exactly. And so I remember asking him, hey, how about if I help you do some product development? Because that was an aspect of what I did in my formal career. I did a lot of product development work in tech and consumer goods and helped to launch products. That was part of my job. So I could see my skill set coming to bear very nicely in this new nascent industry that basically had zero products.
Seems like, you know, the image we all had was a bunch of hippies growing marijuana plants in the woods somewhere here and selling them to people, pot dealers, people in the pot industry. And that's evolved into a whole different understanding that this isn't just about recreational use. This isn't just about getting high. This has found some real medicinal qualities to this plant that we didn't understand 20, 30 years ago when I was introduced to it in my college years.
That is correct. And in fact, the, you know, scientists and researchers really back in the 1930s and 40s were starting to be express their frustration with the Drug Enforcement Agency because they were they had such rigorous regulations. They were throwing anyone who had anything to do with cannabis in jail. And they were already starting to recognize that, hey, there's some therapeutic benefits and you've got such tight controls on this. You're not allowing us to do research and that's not right. So some of the early days, people in the science world were already recognizing the void that was happening because of strict regulations. And now fast forward to 2019, and it's a whole new world. Universities across the planet are getting all the access, or at least better access, to the cannabis they need to conduct research. And there's more and more research being done on cannabis specific to certain conditions, epilepsy, cancer, Parkinson's, just to name a few.
Well, we're here in Southern California in Orange County. We discovered to our amazement that the University of California, Irvine, has a large cannabis center. Scientists there are studying all the different, what do they call them, cannabinoids, properties of the plant.
Right. So they've discovered around 100. There's probably even some more cannabinoids that are being discovered, the primary ones being THC and CBD, at least the most publicized. THC,
right. And THC being the one that got people to use for recreational purposes. That's the one that gets you high, basically.
Yes, but it gets a little bit of a bad rap. There are medicinal reasons that THC helps with, medicinal purposes and therapies. And the psychoactive component really has a negative attribute that I don't think it deserves. And more needs to be understood, more research needs to be done. But a perfect example is pain relief. If you just use CBD, which is the cannabinoid associated with pain relief and anti-inflammation, just CBD
right.
by itself doesn't work so good unless it has some THC with it. And so
that's exactly what they said. They said it's a combination thereof. It's not, you can't just take that THC completely out of the plant and have the same medicinal properties attached to it.
That is true. And so more and more research needs to be done. And there's been anecdotal evidence going on for thousands of years. I mean, the cannabis plant has a long, illustrious history on our planet, which is really quite remarkable. And the fact that it's been kept from people and kept from use in the last 150 years is almost criminal. I mean, when you think about it, the medicinal properties have been used in, you know, ancient civilizations, the Egyptians, the Chinese, the Hindus, the Greeks, the Persians, the Romans. I mean, you go back to ancient manuscripts, there is evidence of cannabis being used for close to 2,000 years. And it wasn't until...
And then you've got all these other associated plants like hemp, which got thrown under the bus along with cannabis, didn't have the same THC component in it, so it never was there to make you feel euphoric or whatever. But hemp's been used for generations for everything from clothing to pharmaceuticals and I think even feedstocks and whatnot. George Washington grew hemp. Everybody grew hemp in the old days, and that got thrown out as well. And hemp itself has CBD oils attached to it.
Right, and so there's new strains being made on both sides of the sort of plant life, whether it's from the more traditional medicinal cannabis plant or the hemp plant. They basically still come from the same plant, but they do respond differently. There's different strains and markers for each of those plants that make them unique and make the way they're grown different. And in some respects, hemp is becoming more like cannabis, and they're able to, there has been development done on cloning and genetics that when it's harvested at the correct time and it's with a certain type of strain, it will yield high levels of CBD and low levels of THC. And so the plants are in many ways are becoming more alike as opposed to less alike. And that is just done through the science and all of the work that's being done on genetics and cloning. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in the years to come. But
well, you are the new face of this new industry. People like you, serious business people with serious business backgrounds who are looking at this as more than just a recreational opportunity to sell another product to people that replaces alcohol. This has got a whole medicinal aspect of it and aspects we haven't even begun to understand because, as you said, of these, they call them cannabinoids. Is that the correct? I think I mispronounced
correct.
It earlier. And these are what? These are properties of the plant? These are...
It's a chemical, right? It is a element, a component of the plant.
All these different elements have yet, they've identified all these different 130, 140 different aspects of the plant, of which we've only begun to understand one or two of them. We understood the THC component, because that's when I was a kid in college, that's all we cared about was, you know, the euphoric feeling we got from smoking marijuana. We didn't know there was any anti-inflammatory, anti-pain control. We didn't know it could be used in epilepsy and dozens of other diseases here, cancer and whatnot. We never thought it had any medicinal aspect to it whatsoever. But as people have begun to re-examine this plant and begin to explore and understand what it can do, an industry is being born before our eyes here. Talk about the industry in California. What's happened in the last few years? How has cannabis gone from being demonized and prohibited to suddenly being the most popular topic we get on this station?
Well, if you look at, I'm going to give you just a little bit of history because I think it boils down to California really being a front runner in so many aspects of the cannabis culture. And it really goes back, you could even say 200 years. Cannabis back in the late 1700s, hemp was grown here and cultivated for rope and fiber. And they believe it all started in Mission San Jose. And then in the approximately the early 1800s, they were producing over 200,000 pounds of hemp in California.
Wow.
Hard to believe. That's a lot of hemp.
I had no idea that we were part of the original experimentation with this plant way back when.
Way back when. And then there was a series of revolutions. Mexico was rebelling against the Spanish crown, which resulted in the crop being cut, and all the hemp farms were eventually abandoned. Then fast forward to the 19th century, and the early Armenian, Turk, and Arab immigrants of that time were growing the psychoactive version of cannabis, referred to as marijuana, and they were growing it in California for their own local consumption. So that's what really brought it back in the early 1900s. Now, at or around the same time, in other states, not in the California, but in the U.S., there was a fear of Hispanic and Black immigrants who used to smoke marijuana in those days, and that's when the whole government propaganda reefer madness kicked in. And that was really driven by the government to create fear with white citizens over Hispanic and Black immigrants coming into the U.S. So it was unfortunately used as a propaganda and a political weapon.
And again, I don't know if this is anecdotal, if this is really true or not, but I've also read reports just through the years that some people even suspect some companies like DuPont and others helped create this fear in this plant because they were trying to create other alternatives to fibers. They were creating rayon and other sorts of artificial fibers to replace the plant-grown fibers. And they were trying to replace their own medicines with plant-based medicines.
Could be. I hadn't heard that theory, but it certainly could be. And there's, you know, whole things with Monsanto related to their patents on corn genetics that I know are pretty frightening. So how that progressed is with the propaganda and a number of things, the rest of the country started to pass a Poison and Pharmacy Act, which basically banned the sale of cocaine, morphine, and opium without a prescription. And then shortly thereafter, marijuana was added to the list. And California became one of the first states to actually prohibit cannabis, even though we were one of the first states to grow hemp. So kind of ironic. And then in
so all these years went by and it remained a, what do they call it, Schedule One drug. It's prohibited to possess. It's prohibited to research unless you had a special permit at a university or something here. This was a plant that was dead and buried. And yet somehow it survived and thrived in the culture and to the recent point, which allowed what? Suddenly the world, the aging baby boomers said, I'm looking for something different. I'm looking for alternatives. I'm going to the mother's markets of the world. I'm willing to look at other things other than drugs to solve my problems here.
Well, I guess, you know, you could really attribute it to the hippies. God bless the hippies. And you could say that fortunately, some brave men and women refused to follow the mandate that marijuana needed to die in California. So the hippie culture really continued to experiment with cannabis, and they ultimately kept it alive. And then in and around the mid-1960s, there was a big movement, obviously the hippie movement and free culture movement of the 1960s. And then there was a series of events that happened in San Francisco. So San Francisco was really ground zero for the movement to legalize. And there was a group called LAMAR, Legalized Marijuana Group, which was the first group formed in the United States to start to combat cannabis as criminal. Because from about the mid-1930s, up until the mid-1960s, 50% of all narcotic arrests had to do with cannabis, and the punishment was severe. A single possession, 1 to 10 years prison sentence, and potentially if you were selling cannabis, 15 years in prison. If you got a third offense, lifetime imprisonment. Pretty severe punishment for a plant.
Yeah. And I think there was a general feeling, too, in just the population as a whole, certainly in the law enforcement community. What are we doing? We're putting an awful lot of effort into locking up an awful lot of people for something that doesn't seem like that big of a deal or that big of a problem.
That's true. And again, some of the cities in Northern California led the charge. In San Francisco, they had a measure that went through in 1991, where the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution stating that the district attorney and police would reduce marijuana crimes to the lowest possible priority offenses. And that was followed by other Northern California cities. And ultimately, that campaign led to the legalization as it gathered momentum in California. And of course, the big date being November 5th, 1996, where 55% of California voters voted to legalize cannabis for medical uses. And that became Proposition 215, Prop 215, which was really the famous ordinance that was passed in the Golden State to allow illegal access to cannabis for medicinal use. And that was the beginning. And then ultimately, the biggest of those days was November 8, 2016, when 57% of our voters said yes to Prop 64, which was the full legalization and sale of marijuana in California.
And it seems like in a relatively short period of time, it went from being stigmatized and marginalized to suddenly being accepted, to suddenly being a recognized medical alternative and a very popular one. I mean, I know people who never smoked marijuana who wouldn't ever consider cannabis as a part of their consumption or conversations, of all ages, suddenly saying, well, what else you got here? I can't sleep. What else you got for cancer and pain and whatnot here? What else you got other than opioids, which are suddenly understandably out of fashion here?
Well, I think this all contributes to how we look at healthcare and self-care. And if you look at the trends that have happened as we've become an industrialized society, we've all gotten very comfortable, a little too comfortable with the convenience of the magic pill. Take this pill for this, take this pill for that.
Yeah.
And yes, some of those pills all have gotten their roots from plant-based and other natural elements. But at the end of the day, they've all been converted to an unnatural form, a pill.
Which is overprescribed and instantly available to everybody, to the point we have now major epidemics across the country of overprescription and overuse of these pills.
That is correct. I think the human body is telling us something. It's telling us this is not the way to go. We need to get back to more natural therapies. We need to get back to medicines that are just more gentle and not more chemicalized. And the fact that people have severe side effects to the medications is a testament. It's sad when you watch a commercial for a pharmaceutical and the majority of the commercial is telling you, if you have suicidal thoughts or if you bleed from
these
your nose,
horrible side effects.
Call your doctor immediately. Well, it's all too real. And I think we've all got too accustomed to a quick fix in our health. And I think cannabis is showing us a new way to take control of our healthcare, take control of feeling better. And not that cannabis is for everyone, but that we need to look at alternative forms of wellness and not just rely on the simplicity of a chemically generated pill.
I agree. And more of us, whether it was the move to other herbs or other alternative or non-Western medical practices, we're all suddenly, I don't care, left, right, or center, we're all suddenly, as we get older, looking for other alternatives that don't sound as awful as the pill. We've been promised we'll take care of everything that turns us into a drug zombie here. So I think there's certainly been a rapid acceptance of this. I'm amazed at the very conservative, very business types coming through here every day talking about the new business of cannabis. What can we expect to hear on your show?
I am looking forward to dispelling some of the myths about cannabis and the misconceptions. There are some people working very hard in the cannabis trenches every day that have a story to tell. I think a lot of people believe that people in the cannabis industry are walking around with bags of cash. That's really not true. Or they think we're stoned all the time. Not true. The cannabis business is really hard work. And add to that a landscape that is constantly shifting and changing. The approval of legal cannabis in California was certainly exciting, but it has added a host of complexities that are not very easy to navigate. And we're all working very hard to address those challenges and to stay compliant and to produce safe products for people in our beautiful state. And it's not as easy as it sounds. So I hope with Collective Wisdom, my goal is to shed some light by sharing knowledge from people that are in those cannabis trenches. I'm looking forward to real conversations with an interesting and diverse variety of people from the cannabis space. I want to talk about their successes, their challenges, what their visions for the future are, and be able to learn and share that information with others, not only people in the industry, but those who are just looking for information, and they're trying to really understand what's really going on behind the curtain of the cannabis world.
Like your husband, are toying with the idea of entering into this space. Maybe there's millions to be made. Maybe this is a whole new industry waiting to be born. Who knows? But as you look at it, there are certainly a lot of obstacles as we create a new regulatory environment, for example. How do you measure it? How do you monitor it? How do you package it? How do you distribute it? How do you sell it? There's certainly issues still with the banking and the monetary aspect of it, because on a federal level, it's still a prohibited drug. It may be okay here in California and a growing number of other states, but banks don't know what to do with it. And so they can't accept credit card payments. They can only accept cash to buy this. All of those are issues that are being worked out as we talk about here. Are you going to dig into some of those things? We're going to hear about laws and regulation and packaging and distribution.
Yes, we are. And in fact, some of the interviews that we've conducted already have been fascinating, where we've talked to some of the folks from the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And this is the division of the Bureau of Cannabis Control that monitors, guides, and regulates all the growers. And so how does that work? How are they protecting the planet and protecting water use and dealing with pesticides and all the things related to the very beginning of the travel of that plant till it gets to a retail store? It has to be grown.
Yeah.
So we've talked to people from the CDFA. They were wonderful and they had some great things to share. And they're really there to be a helpful guide to the growers because they realize the growers have a tough job.
It is like any food product in that sense. It's not, I don't know if you'd consider it a food product, but it's something certainly edible. I'm going to digest it. I'm going to eat it like I would anything else. And so I've got to be concerned about what additives are in there that I didn't expect. Dosage, how much of the different compounds are present in the plant? Is it as advertised or not? And is it just safe handling like you would any food product here? Is it contaminated at any point in the process here? All of those are issues they're still trying to figure out as we speak. And I know those are obstacles and hurdles for dispensaries and distributors and everyday consumers as they wonder, is it safe? Is it legal? And am I getting what I think I'm getting?
Yes. And one of the big things that's happening in the industry right now is the whole distinction between the illegal market and the legal market.
Yes.
And
right.
So people in the legal market, companies that have, you know, sold their soul, they've invested everything, they're working to get compliant, and they already are, the majority. And
they're doing testing, they're doing packaging, they're tracking it to the, as they say, from farm to table, you know, from the moment it's grown to the minute it's sold. They're trying to track its whole distribution of it.
That's right. And so you've got everyone in the legal market working hard to do the best they can to get great products to market. Then you've got the illegal market that is working on the sidelines, that doesn't have to pay excise tax, that doesn't have to pay for lab tests, that doesn't have to pay for expensive packaging or taxes to the local municipalities. So a myriad of other costs that the legal market has, the illegal market doesn't. And the consumer doesn't always understand that. And all they know is I can buy product for 25 to 35% less. So I'm going to buy from the illegal shop down the street.
That you may not know is illegal. It's there. It's doing business. Seems like it's okay. Great. I can go buy it here. I don't know why it's so much cheaper, but and maybe it's where they're sourcing the product or whatnot. We went through this with the herbal supplements. You'd go to a store and, you know, one store had it at one price and somebody else had it at a different price. Well, it turned out this other one is from China and it's not measured. It's not monitored. It's all sorts of things. You may not even be getting what you think you're getting, or you may be getting other things you didn't know were in there.
Yes, that is a problem. And that is a huge concern for the legal market right now. Another subset of that is because it's now legal, the worst that's going to happen to an illegal operator is they get a misdemeanor. So whereas you used to be able to go to jail, now the risk is minimal for illegal operators. So a lot of cities are trying to figure out what is going to be their enforcement strategy. How are they going to shut down these shops? Because for every illegal shop that's operating, they're not driving consumers to legal shops where the taxes are collected. And obviously the cities benefit from that. And in some ways, the cities need those funds, right? They need to improve schools and roads and libraries and provide health services.
That's why they approved it. That's why they brought it into the community here. Right, exactly. That was part of their hope. Well, so many aspects of this have yet to be figured out. And I think it does take some collective wisdom. Nobody has the one answer to how this. No one city, no one company, no one organization has figured it out. It's a collective effort to try and create this new cannabis space, as you call it, and to turn it into something that is measurable and safe and repeatable and is an asset to everybody, not just a problem that so many feared for so many years.
Yes, and that's exactly why I want to produce this podcast. I just feel the time is right and people need more information, and I'm very excited about doing it.
Well, I can't think of many places I can go get these answers. I look forward to hearing them on your show each and every week. Thanks for stepping forward and taking on this challenge. It's a big challenge. But as a early adopter and a leader in this space, I look forward to the people that you bring on each and every week to talk about this ever-evolving business of cannabis.
Thank you, Paul. I look forward to it as well.
That's this week's episode of the Collective Wisdom Podcast. Join us each week for another episode on OC Talk Radio, streaming on Thursdays at 3 p.m., and you can download Collective Wisdom wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to visit cacollectivewisdom.com or email us at collectivewisdompodcast@gmail.com to join the conversation. Thank you for listening.